Thank you very much. Very pleased to be here today. Congratulations to all involved with Inter Economics on its 50th anniversary. It's a few years older than me. This is going to be a bit of a challenge to do in 20 minutes, because the last time I presented on this topic, I talked for more than an hour. So I'll kind of go through, there's a lot of graphs and a lot of material. I'll try to go through it quite quickly and just get the essence across of this. This is the second paper that my co-author, Kieran McQuinn, and I have written on this specific topic of looking at growth potential in the euro area. And we published a paper in the CES IFO studies in 2008 that was written prior to the crisis. And one of the things that it flagged was very weak growth in total factor productivity. For those who don't know what that is, I'll explain it. As a source of concern for longer-term growth potential in the euro area. The updated version of this further emphasizes that the intervening years have not provided any good news on that front. And in addition to that, have brought forward a set of demographic issues that were not quite as relevant for the medium-term future when we were writing our paper in 2007 and 8, but that are starting to become very relevant. So the first point to get across here is that the economy, European economy, euro area economy, faces very, very strong negative headwinds in the face of unchanged policies. Then we talk about what changes in policies might look like, and in particular, we talk about so-called structural reforms. Structural reforms is a sort of a magic phrase in European policy circles, and it's the cure to everything. We take a fairly simple but detailed approach to structural reforms, which is we consider a set of types of structural reforms, and then basically just assume that they achieve a desired outcome. We don't go through the mechanism by which they manage to do so, which is much more complicated, and assume they do so over a certain time period. And then we look at just sort of mechanically how the increase in inputs, more people at work, more capital, how that translates into more growth at a European level. For data reasons, we largely focus on we focus completely on the euro area 12 countries. And when I talk about the euro area, it's not really the euro area. It's the euro area as it used to be. And we also do a series of country-by-country analysis. I won't emphasize the country-specific analysis in this talk. I'll just focus on the aggregate. That's already talked about sobering findings, I guess. What's the framework? The framework is a very simple framework. We treat the euro area economy as though, and all of its country member states, as though all GDP is produced with a Cobb-Douglas production function of this type, which implies a growth accounting equation, so that output growth is a function of growth in labor input, which we measure as hours worked, growth in the capital stock. There's a weighted average of those. We very scientifically set the weight on capital to one-third and the weight on labor to two-thirds, just based on very strong Bayesian priors. You can redo these calculations with different weights. The basic story ends up being very similar. So total factor productivity growth is basically that part of GDP growth that doesn't come from more inputs. And it's a very important element of growth. And I'll signal in a minute a little bit why it is that it's so important. We do these calculations for the euro area. A comparison for the United States is useful as well. One thing to know, the second column in, the so-called the delta A column, that's our total factor productivity estimate, is that total factor productivity growth has worsened in every decade that we look at. So we start our data set in 1970 and then look at a number of years and keep going forward after that, and we find declines over each decade. Over the past 15 years, since the year 2000 up to 2015, total factor productivity growth in the euro area has increased by 2/10, according to our calculations. Now, our calculations depend on a lot of specific assumptions. Wouldn't worry too much about this, about that specific number, but the basic point that total factor productivity growth has worsened is extremely robust. That's an estimate that we run at of a sort of trend. It gets us through two cycles. It goes through some years that were good years. It goes through some years that are bad years. Things are recovering again. We did first do these calculations with data excluding the last 2 years. In the last couple of weeks, we've updated them, including 2014 and 2015, which were pretty good years, relatively speaking, for the euro area economy. 2015 euro area GDP was over 2%. Doesn't change these numbers at all. 2/10 is still the number. And in fact, last year's 2% euro area GDP growth is a bit of a fuzzy number. About 0.5% of that relates to the famous 26% Irish GDP growth, which is something to do with Apple moving its headquarters. It's not. So that's 0.5% on TFP growth last year, all thanks to somebody that made a decision that's nothing to do with real actual GDP. So So this is a point, is that 2/10 total factor productivity growth does not mean we never have good years. We can have good years. We can have years with 2% GDP growth, but it means you're getting 2% GDP growth based on increases in inputs as opposed to total factor productivity. And those increases in inputs may not be sustainable. Just some sort of graphs to illustrate. There's GDP growth. That's our measure of hours growth. So as we can see, there's a lot of labor input growth has been reasonably substantial over the past couple of years. Here's a very important point, capital stock growth. By our estimates, euro area capital stock used to grow between 2 and 2.5%. It's not that surprising. The economy used to grow between about 2 and 2.5%. Because we've had such a long slump in investment, euro area capital stock growth is now something on the order of 0.5 to 0.6%, according to our calculations. Again, these are sensitive to specific ways you want to do the calculation, but the general trend is going to look this way, however you do it. Purely from the mechanical way that we translate capital stock growth into output growth, this on its own, capital stock growth used to be about 2 to 2.5, and now it's about 5 to 6 tenths. That's subtracting about 6 to 7 tenths per year cap off euro area GDP growth in terms of supply potential. And that's an extremely large number that people should understand. Because if we go through some of the potential structural reforms and things that they can do, what you're going to see is there probably isn't a structural reform in Europe that's going to add 6 to 7 tenths to GDP growth per year. So very weak private investment is perhaps on its own the single biggest thing subtracting from euro area supply capacity growth. And there's our chart for total factor productivity growth. And we see a little perk up at the end, but if you were to subtract off the 5 tenths for the Irish mystery miracle, it wouldn't look quite so good. The poor TFP growth is very, very important for the long-run potential growth in the economy. This goes back to Robert Solow's famous work. So what Solow showed is that if you have a Cobb-Douglas production function, if you have a production function of this sort with total factor productivity growing at a steady rate, let's say G, in this case, over the long run, the economy is only going to grow at rate G over 1 minus alpha. So you can have increase in inputs, but because of diminishing marginal productivity, you don't get sustained extra growth. So the Solow sort of rule of thumb was basically that on a steady growth path, total factor productivity should account for about 2/3 of GDP growth and capital deepening the other. What we're seeing when we look at the data for Europe is the opposite. It's that capital deepening, although not as strong as it used to be, increases in capital per worker, is still accounting for a much bigger fraction of GDP, Right? So the bad news here is that weak as capital stock growth has been, the predictions of growth models are that if total factor productivity continues to be as weak as it is, then capital stock growth is going to weaken even further. So in other words, for long-run growth potential in the economy, total factor productivity is what drives the growth potential of the economy. And total factor productivity growth in the euro area can be approximated over the past two decades as something like a two-tenths trend, which is extremely poor. The other major negative supply-side factor are demographic changes. The euro area population is still growing. However, the population of people in the euro area aged 15 to 64 in the traditional working age bracket has been declining since 2010, and the chart on the right-hand side shows that it really falls very dramatically. It's projected to fall very dramatically. So these are Eurostat's projections. So we have extremely poor productivity growth, and we're going to have less people at work. Put those two things together, that paints a fairly grim picture in terms of future GDP growth. There's a lot of talk about different countries, and Germany is aging and other countries are aging. In fact, the striking thing, if you look at lots of different countries in Europe, is this is happening everywhere. It's just happening at slightly different paces, and we're heading for slightly different places. But it's a pan-European issue in terms of demographic aging and in terms of what's going to happen with the number of workers. To get a sense of what the longer term of the euro economy looks like, we do a very simple simulation projection with a Cobb-Douglas production function. We do a certain scenarios for what's going to happen with investment, for what's going to happen with the labor market, and then just sort of run the model out. And we do this for each country and then aggregate up to the euro area. We start with our sort of key assumption is total factor productivity grows at this two-tenths trend that we've calculated. We then simulate a recovery scenario whereby the recovery that we've seen over the past 2 years continues steadily and uninterrupted by recession out onto about 2020, by which time unemployment rates have fallen to their pre-crisis average over the decade beforehand, where the investment share of GDP has come back to its pre-crisis average. That's quite a big assumption. And we project labor force participation to evolve in a way that within cohorts, within five-year age cohorts, labor force participation stays the same. But, of course, the total changes because the composition of the population changes. So because of aging, we're able to track what happens with labor force participation. Okay, we don't assume any changes within cohorts, but the overall does change. We also assume that the average amount of hours that people work in the work week stays flat at the level of 2015, which is quite optimistic, actually, because that's trended downwards. The last couple of years, it's sort of gone sideways. So maybe that's the start of a new pattern. Okay, this illustrates our assumptions. One striking point that comes out of this. Even with a recovery scenario in which unemployment rates fall in all of these countries back to their pre-crisis average, the average of the decade prior to the crisis, there's almost no growth up to the end of the decade in the total amount of hours worked across the euro area. And then after that, it declines very steadily. The chart on the right shows the basic solo model point about capital stock growth. There's a recovery for a couple of years because of our scenario of investment coming back to its pre-crisis share, but ultimately the model heads towards this sort of solo model steady state in which the capital stock would be growing at three-tenths per year. And there's a long-run future for GDP growth and for GDP per hour. In numbers that people can see, the projection is GDP growth to be three-tenths over the next decade, followed by 1.5, 0.21, basically three-tenths over the next decade. Now, All of that is a function of a 2/10 total factor productivity growth number. And you can argue and quibble with that, and you can add a half percentage point on if you want, and then you could basically take most of these numbers and move them up by that. But there's nothing in the data over the past couple of decades to suggest much more optimism. And one would have to be extremely optimistic to come up with assumptions that give us one percentage point or more as an average growth rate for GDP. Okay, so, but I hear you say that's not what our future is going to look like because we're going to have lots of structural reforms, right? Let me very briefly describe some structural reforms. And again, our scenario, our methodology here is very simple. We assume the structural reforms of three different types achieve the outcomes that you would hope that they do achieve. Right? So one is labor market reform. Now, not every European labor market obviously needs reform. Right? Lots of countries have had low unemployment rates prior to the crisis. Some have low unemployment rates now. So when we take a look at the Euro Area 12, we see five countries that prior to the crisis had average unemployment rates below 6%. It's not clear, you know, I don't think anybody's considering a structural reform scenario in which we have a US-style labor market all across Europe and the average unemployment rates are, you know, as low as they are in the United States during a boom, right? So I think 6% is pretty good, right? So we leave the five countries that had unemployment rates below 6% prior to the crisis. We leave them alone. We don't inflict a labor market. You know, good news for Germany. There isn't a second round of labor market reforms about to arrive because McQuinn and Whelan have recommended it. Seven other countries could benefit from a labor market reform, and that reduces the total euro area unemployment rate in steady state to 5.6% instead of what would be nearly 8% in the baseline. And that's a fantastic thing. And that means millions of people in Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, lots and lots of people will have jobs. Individual prosperity will be changed dramatically by that. What would it do for GDP growth? Well, we assume that these changes in unemployment rate get phased in over about 10 years. Labor market reforms are not easy to do, and the impacts aren't quick. If that happens over 10 years, what does that do for euro area growth? It adds 0.16%, right? So great, it's worth doing, but it's not a catalyst for radically higher growth. Another one is pensions. One of the issues keeps growth or has an impact on supply side growth potential in Europe is a lot of people retire early. And pension systems allow them to do so. So we could reform our pension system to keep people at work longer. OECD has highlighted Switzerland as an example of a country that could be copied in terms of keeping people in the labor force. So we have a calculation where we go through and impose over 20 years a change in labor force participation rates in every country in Europe so that once somebody is in the workforce at age 50, that the chance that they stay in the workforce up to 65, becomes a Swiss, right? So everybody in Europe, every 50-year-old turns into a 50-year-old Swiss person, right? And that's pretty dramatic in terms of the impact that it has on labor force participation. But it doesn't get labor force participation to increase. It just makes it fall at a slower rate than it would. What does that do for GDP growth? Again, we simulate this as something that would happen over 20 years, right? These would be major, major changes. It would be difficult to implement that kind of you know, somebody who's 50 now, do we tell them, that's it, buddy, you're going Swiss immediately. Pension system, you know, is being gradually reformed. We don't. So it probably takes a long time. So what does it do for growth over a 30-year period? It adds about 2/10. Again, that's great, that's well worth doing, but it doesn't radically turn Europe into some kind of growth engine. Very last, a lot of the reforms that people have in mind, sort of regulatory reforms, product market reforms, are things that people imagine would boost total factor productivity. Now, actually, in practice, linking any of these reform measures, as measured by OECD or the World Bank or whomever, to total factor productivity is notoriously difficult and tricky. But let's assume that it can do so. One scenario we go for in our paper is to assume that broad regulatory reform allows total factor productivity to convert in all the euro area countries to converge over 30 years to the highest level according to the Penn World Tables, which maybe perhaps surprisingly, actually the highest is Luxembourg. We can't tell everybody to be like Luxembourg. So the highest one apart from Luxembourg in Europe in the Penn World Tables is the UK, right? But in a way, you kind of think about that. What that would mean is a regulatory reform position so that everywhere in product markets, labour markets, everywhere look like the UK. Okay, so lots of shopping up and down the Berlin streets on a Sunday and all that stuff, right? How long would that take? And what would UK TFP growth probably be? We have UK TFP growth of 0.3% based on, while the level is high, the growth rate has not been good. What would that do? Well, combined labour and pension reforms would add 0.26% over 30 years. If you added in this total factor productivity growth scenario, it would have the potential to add 0.8% to growth. Now, some of the individual countries, for instance, Greece, you're looking at 1.5%. Right? So in that sense, you know, if your instinct is that Greece would benefit from large-scale structural reforms that turns Greece's institutions into British institutions, you'd be correct. Of course, the caveats on all of that is it's very, very difficult to do. One very last point I'd make is that all of these calculations are kind of quite mechanical. And when I think about caveats, almost all the caveats are towards the effects being smaller rather than bigger. You know, we can make older people stay in the labor force and work for longer because of pension reforms. That doesn't mean that they're going to be as productive as the average worker, which is what we've assumed here. It's also likely to be the case that reforms that are introduced are partial and don't fully achieve the kinds of outcomes that we have here. Okay, there's an enormous research agenda here about these institutions, the different structural reforms that can be introduced, and exactly the angles through which they can have these impacts. But ultimately, I think structural reforms of the style people are thinking about are probably not a silver bullet to ignite fast growth in Europe. Most likely, the biggest thing we can do is reverse the demographic trends via large immigration on a much larger scale than is currently envisaged. But, of course, that has its own political issues. The very last point, we talk all the time about structural reforms and increasing the supply potential of the euro area growth, but with the unemployment rate at 10.1% still, the GDP in Europe is still well short of its current supply potential. So there's still, as has been the case for years, a very strong argument for a large euro-wide capital investment program that would boost the current supply-side potential of the euro area economy, which is badly struggling because of weak private sector investment. And with that, I'll take a seat. I've probably talked into my one question time, so I think I'll maybe just sit down and we'll let the next speaker get up.
Any very short questions? I think this linked nicely up with Dr. Andor was talking about absolute versus relative growth, because you actually said that a very extensive reform agenda could more than double the growth rate in Europe, which is relatively quite impressive, absolute. Nothing like it was in the past. One short question.
So you considered a closed market economy, right? So the solo classical, neoclassical models of a closed market economy. How would your results change if you had considered an open market economy, considering trade and exports, imports, and so forth, so on and so forth?
The point is, the euro area is largely a relatively closed economy. It's a big, relatively closed economy. But ultimately, it's not so much that it's a closed economy. I mean, open economy versions of these growth models break the link between savings and investment, right? So investment is determined by other factors. What we say in the paper is that investment will return to its pre-crisis average level, which is probably a bit, based on current trends, that seems a little optimistic. So it's possible there may be global forces out there that either are suppressing investment in Europe or global opportunities out there that mean we could have higher investment shares in Europe, but I don't have any prior information to suggest that either is the case.